Good morning and welcome. Thank you for being with us on our roundtable panel for this Monday, the 19th of January. Very nice to have you with us, and we welcome you. Let me introduce our panel, and then I'll let you in on how you can be a part of our conversation this morning. It's very easy, so you don't have to like write it down or anything, but if you want to. Here we go. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joseph.
Very nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
WAMC newsman Ray Graff is here. Good morning, Raymond.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
And God, I hope he feels that it's nice to be here. NYPIRG's legislative director Blair Horner is with us.
Yes, it's great to be here, and I wore my ice skates to get in today.
We thank you very much for making it in and tracking in and all of that. We welcome you to be a part of our conversation, roundtable@wamc.org. And you can also comment on our webpage, which is wamc.org/roundtable. And today's post is 1/19/15 panel. And there's a cool picture of a microphone there, and you just click on it. Ray grunts as if he didn't design it. And you didn't?
No.
No, okay.
No.
All right, good. And
Immaculate Conception for that one.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You're all set and ready to go. You can comment right there. 1/19/15 panel or roundtable at wamc.org. Okay. Let us talk about the topics of the day. President Obama will use his State of the Union address to call on Congress to raise taxes and fees on the wealthiest taxpayers and to the largest financial firms to finance an array of tax cuts for the middle class. Pressing to reshape the tax code to help working families, administration officials released on late Saturday and on Sunday.
Good luck, Charlie.
Why do you say that?
Well, because the Republicans in the Congress, both houses aren't going to do it. But what he achieves by doing it is pointing out that there is a huge inequity in wealth in this country, and that the 1% which controls so much of the rest of it isn't willing to share. Now, that's a very dangerous place for them to be in. That is the kind of thing that in the past has led to revolutions. I don't believe it's going to happen in this country, but I do believe it could lead to a revolution in the electorate, and I think that they're counting on that.
Well, I agree with that. I mean,
my carbonated beverage.
I was going to. My coffee doesn't make that sound. I agree, though. I mean, the president's laying down a marker, basically. He's saying, I want to fund these very popular programs. I got to come up with a way to do it. I'm going to do it by reshaping the tax code. And the articles that we looked at on this is he'd raise roughly $300 billion or so and spend basically half of it or so on the programs he wants to fund. It's one of these things where I think Americans have to start thinking to themselves, the price of civilization are taxes. And if we want to have bridges that work, roads that aren't filled with potholes, and an educated citizenry, you have to pay money to do that. And we have to get away from just saying taxes are bad under every circumstance.
Well, there's another part of this, though, Blair, that I think, look, if every American just understood the simplicity of what you're saying, it's quite right. But many Americans take a look around in their towns and see money and see people who are wasting what they consider to be money. So it's like unions, you know. Conceptually, a lot of people agree that we need unions. But when you see union leadership that takes advantage of their position, that kind of thing, it creates either symbolically or otherwise people who are not happy about unions. We know this from all of the research and everything that happens. The same thing about taxes. Everybody knows something in their town that could have been done easier or a little bit tighter than is happening.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you see that everywhere in the world,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
I mean, but the end of the day, when you look at how are we doing as a country, we have a lower lifespan than most Western developed countries. We have higher.
Is it because of taxes?
Well, it's because of programs, right? I mean, if you have universal health care in the rest of the country, of all these other countries in the Western world, and people don't have to pay for their health care, for example, they're going to get better care and they're going to live longer. And that costs money. Everything costs money. There's no such thing as a free lunch anywhere on the planet. And if we want to live better, we have to pay to do it. Now, I agree with Alan's point. that you got to have reforms to make sure that the money isn't wasted, of course. But the argument isn't reform. The argument is taxes are bad. It's not that the programs need to be reformed. The argument is taxes are bad. The government is the problem, as if it's not ours. And that's, I think, that fundamental problem has to be addressed head on. The president sort of does that, but he doesn't do it hard enough, in my opinion.
Well, there's another argument to be made about this, and that's Orrin Hatch's argument that says basically the economy, and interestingly, Orrin Hatch would agree with Allen's premise that the economy is improving and doing better. And Orrin Hatch says, and I think he's quoted in this New York Times, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Basically, if you lay more taxes on the small businesses, and if you're hitting a $500,000 annual threshold, a lot of that is going to be on the small businesses for upping that tax rate to 28%. If you're going to overtax the businesses, don't you, to some extent, run the risk of deflating all of the improvement in the business sector that has been happening?
This is Reaganomics, classical, and trickle-down theory. If the people at the top are allowed to keep and
answer the question.
Well, what do you mean? Yes, I am trying to answer the question.
He's getting there. He's warming up. These are like calisthenics.
I am trying to answer the question. I'm trying to say there's always give and take. There's a lot of adjustment that you can make so that small business owners are protected. But we're talking about small business owners. We're not talking about the people who own it all and who are really impossible.
Still, the 500 that basically couples with incomes above $500,000, yeah, as I understand this, would have their rate go from 23.5 to 28%. Right, on capital gains. But that's a lot of small business. And so if, in fact, we buy the premise, the narrative, that the economy is on the upswing, and small businesses play a big part in this, does slapping more tax on that business negate what is now looks like a turnaround in the economy? That's Orrin Hatch's question.
Well, are you sure that slapping individual taxes on somebody who's making $500,000 is a tax on the business?
Well, clearly, those who own successful small businesses are going to fall into that more than you or I.
No, they're going to get taxed on their individual income. That doesn't mean you're taxing the business out of existence, does it?
This is, again, this is the president's proposal, as best we understand it, includes a provision on changing the capital gains tax rate from 23 plus to 28. And Hatch's argument is if you raise the capital gains rate 4%+, you'll have a negative impact on the economy. I actually don't believe it. We've had higher capital gains in the past. We've had lower capital gains in the past. The capital gain is not your income tax credit. Again, but that's a technical fight. If Hatch wants to fight about the capital gains tax, then that's an issue. But the basic premise that the president is saying is shift more of the tax burden to those who have an ability to pay, use some of the money for programs that the public wants and needs, and use the rest, you know, to help pay for the cost of the government itself. We're running deficits every year. Who pays for that, right? The people that have the most money should pay more to do that.
Surely you see that, Ray.
Come on, Ray.
What, does Orrin Hatch see it?
Well,
he's in Utah.
Orrin Hatch, well, also he's a spokesman for them. I mean,
for them. Listen, Jacques Hughes. For them.
Well, we're talking about a very small group of people, relatively small group of people, less than 1% of the country, who own huge amounts of the wealth in this country. And they elect legislators and they elect senators, and they have, we call them them. And they,
many
and,
of whom are Democrats.
Yes, many
yes,
of
okay,
whom are Democrats.
Just to make it clear.
Well, I mean,
this
is sort of a Gilded Age kind of argument we're having right now, right? I mean, this is basically, we have this extremely wealthy, very, very sharply pointed pyramid of income with people at the very top making an enormous amount of money. And they're the big campaign donors. They're the people that hire the lobbyists. The problem with the president's plan, of course, is what you started with, is what is the political likelihood that it'll happen? The odds are probably, you know, zero on the Kelvin scale. But he is laying down a marker, and he's going to force the debate. If you want these popular programs, how are you going to pay for them? And that's, I think, where he wants to put the Republicans in a box.
And once again, we see the president having some guts about, you know, all of this and bringing the fight. Bring it, which I really love.
So the third paragraph in this article from The New York Times says, the decision to present the plan during Tuesday's speech marks the start of a debate over taxes and the economy that will shape both Mr. Obama's legacy and the 2016 presidential campaign. So I want to get to that idea of legacy.
Yeah, but one more
okay,
thing.
You don't get the win, but you do get the points.
But one more thing. The Republicans have to be very careful, it seems to me. The people at the top have to be very careful. If you take everything, if you leave nothing, you basically incite at least a political revolution. I'm not saying a physical revolution, but a political revolution. FDR was called a traitor to his class, but he saved his class. That was the whole point. And that's what this is, too. I mean, if you say to everybody, if you say to a Ray Graff, you can't have your house. We're kicking you out of your house.
Oh, take it.
please. Take my house, please.
Feel free.
Fix the roof while you're at it.
Get in line.
You can't have your house, or you say to somebody, you can't have adequate schooling. Believe me, it just is a matter of time until people say, okay, this has gone far enough.
Well, I'm not sure about a legacy, actually. I mean, the legacy for Obama would be is if he shapes a political agenda that drives the 2016 elections and the Democrats sweep. I mean, that's really the kind of legacy I think that we're really talking about. Will his programs exist beyond his presidency is really the legacy. And so if he can create a political environment where the Democratic agenda has popular support, he may be able to influence what happens in the 2016 election. So the point in the article, I think, really connects the two. It's really about 2016. A Democratic president getting elected in 2016 is far less likely to roll back Obama's victories, such that they are, than a Republican one.
Can we take a quick break?
Sure.
And then we'll come back and we'll continue this conversation and we'll welcome people to comment as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org, and you can also go to WAMC.org/roundtable and comment there as well. We'll be right back after the short break.
Support comes from Brad Will, Shokin Architecture and Planning in Kingston's Midtown Arts District. Energy-efficient architecture and planning throughout the Mid-Hudson Valley, ashokanarchitecture.com. And Elms College, Chicopee, Massachusetts, working to educate students with their core values of faith, community, justice, and excellence. Elms.edu.
Hallelujah. Keep on. Now maybe someday I'll reach that higher goal. I know I can make it with just a little bit of soul.
Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel on this holiday Monday. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org, or WAMC.org/roundtable to comment on our website. Alan Chartok, Ray Graff, Blair Horner, I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your comments. We have comments to share with you.
We do. George says, a tax on capital gains affects rich individuals. I think I was saying something like that, wasn't I, just now?
It depends on how you define rich. This is my point.
Over $500,000 is the way it's being defined here in income. Okay. A tax on capital gains affects rich individuals, not small businesses. Improvements in infrastructure help small businesses, both directly and indirectly, parentheses, as the construction workers buy from them. That's from George. All right. And then James says, why can't we equate paying one's share of taxes with one's patriotism? Those who refuse to agree to pay a fair share of income to support their government should be condemned as unpatriotic. To many corporations, politicians, and individuals pound their two is spelled incorrectly. So too many corporations, politicians, and individuals pound their chests with pride of country and yet refuse to contribute.
Oh,
okay.
So we're in New York, then, we're really, really patriotic. because we pay a lot of taxes.
That's what I've always said, particularly in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And Wes from Schenectady says, in December 2012, the Republicans agreed to raise taxes on family with taxable income over $450 after insisting they would never do so. Really? $450?
$450,000 probably.
Yeah, $450,000 probably. Okay. And David says, oh boy. Boy, oh boy. Not taxing unrealized capital gains at death costs about $43 billion a year or $430 billion 10 years, which is more than $320 billion over 10 years that Obama wants to raise. Suppose X buys a stock for $10,000. He holds the stock, and when he croaks, stock is worth $50,000. Y inherits stock and later sells it for $80,000. Y pays capital gains tax on $80,000 minus $50,000, $30,000 instead of $80,000 minus $10,000, $70,000. $40,000.
Will there be a test on this?
$40,000 escapes taxation.
Is this in the Common Core?
Because I think we've provoked the accountant listenership here.
That's a good point, though, about the inherited.
Yeah. Well, yes. And the capital gains issue is many small businesses are organized. They pay taxes as individuals. And I think that's where, like Hatch would argue, the small businesses get captured.
Right, you are, Chief.
Well, and Bobby says, taxing the wealthy more than middle class and lower income people is only fair because the wealthy, over $500,000 income, take more of our tax dollars in the way of aid and large deductions for their corporations. One example, sports arenas, stadiums get hundreds of thousands of dollars from the rest of us because our tax dollars are used to build the arenas.
But the wealthy already pay a vast majority of the taxes.
Good. Julius says, I contend that probably most couples whose personal income is over $500,000 per year are professionals who do not own or operate small businesses. If you look at most mom-and-pop small businesses, which may employ a few people, the owner's personal income is not at all guaranteed to hit $500,000. And Joseph says, taxes on the rich and everyone else are the price of admission. Pretty much what Blair was saying, I think.
Price of civilization.
The rich have always sought oligarchy, have always shown distrust in democracy, have always fought against regulation, and have fought efforts that redistribute wealth to prevent the foundation of aristocracy. And Peter says, how many small business persons pay themselves plus $500,000? I'm guessing that's a small percentage, and that's from Bonnie, and who uses somebody else's.
Right. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Bonnie. Okay, that's
all right.
Enough for now.
We are good. Thank you very much. We welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. When we come back, we'll talk about other issues. We'll continue our, and you can continue your commenting on this and those other issues. But first, we're going to get a little news from the BBC, and we'll be back. Set your phasers to exciting. We'll be back right after this. Good morning, and welcome back to the program. A little music history here.
Yeah. House of the Rising Sun, right, Hopper?
Yeah, very, very nice.
Nice.
We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org or WAMC.org/roundtable, and you can comment on the panel link for this date, 1-19-15. Alan Chartok, Ray Graff, and Blair Horner with us this morning, and we always welcome your letters. We've been getting a lot of letters, and we've been talking about taxes. We've been talking about the preview of the State of the Union address, which obviously will be taking place on Tuesday, and we'll be covering that live here on WAMC at 9 p.m. And then coming up at 10 o'clock this morning, we're going to be talking about, we were talking about legacy of the president, and our good friend Dr. Lee Mieringoff will be with us, as I mentioned, who will be for the Marist College Institute poll, right?
Which is big stuff because they do it. He works
NBC
with
now.
NBC yeah. and newspapers, and he's the big man on campus now.
He is indeed, and we'll be talking to him just a little bit after 10 o'clock and talking to him about the president's approval rating and I'm sure about legacy as well. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org, and let us move on to other topics, and that is there are other things.
Well, there's death.
No, I just realized that in the link I sent, I was saying Panetta on Paris, and it came up Panther.
Right. Yeah. I thought that was like a new nickname for the guy.
Yeah, no, so it's...
That's why I didn't read it.
It screwed me up. I was okay.
I was thinking Pink Panther at first, and I wasn't quite sure what I was reading.
Former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta called Sunday for improvements to be made in how terrorists are tracked and information is shared between the United States and its allies, saying that the failure to stop recent attacks in and around Paris was an intelligence failure. Panetta, speaking on CNN, said that the United States has pretty good security when it comes to managing terrorist watch and no-fly lists, but he added that parts of Europe do not, and that they are less aggressive in monitoring potential terrorists returning from countries like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, where they can receive training. And he said, so the real challenge here is going to be for the United States to work very closely with our counterparts in Europe to make sure that these watch lists are shared, that we're working together to make sure that these individuals are being tracked when they try to come back to various countries, and that we work together operationally to be able to go after them once that happens.
Do you really think that the French and the Belgians and the others are so stupid that they don't get that and aren't doing that already? I mean, it's very hard to believe that when young people are going over there with all of the security apparatus and the rest, that governments don't know that. I mean, it sounds to me sort of superfluous. Is that the right word? You know, superfluous meaning...
Well, it could be. It depends on what you mean.
Yeah. Well, what I mean by that is he's just yelling to the clouds, you know what I mean? And but it seems to me they've got to know.
But they didn't.
When people take off. And no, actually, they did.
We knew.
No, they knew.
But did they know?
They knew. They knew about these people. They had them on their lists, but they didn't do anything about it. What can you do?
So are you recommending internment camps? What do you want to do?
No, I didn't get that far yet.
So wasn't the Panetta's argument, though, that these guys were on a no-fly list for us and we didn't share that list with the French?
Was the implication I thought.
Yes. I mean, it seemed like he was being critical of the U.S. policy.
It seems hard. I agree with Alan that I'm sure the French were sort of paying attention to people to come back from these war zones and training camps in Yemen, right? I mean, how many people go to training camps fight in Syria, right? I mean, it's not that many people. I was more struck by the fact that this felt like the comment he was making that it could be the fact that we used to spy on these leaders in Western Europe, and perhaps because we have done that in the past and those cables became public, that maybe people aren't sharing like they used to, and that there may be some other level of discussion that's not occurring as a result.
Did they ever fully share? No, I mean, if you give everyone all the information, then essentially all your intelligence apparatus becomes open source for every country in the world. So you can certainly see parsing the information that you give to even allies, right?
Well, no. I mean, not right. Because if you don't share, I mean, you're talking about the evils of sharing. Now, if you don't share, you get what you got.
That's right. Well, and also, do people act on the information? I mean, the guy, the Boston bombers, we had been alerted by the Russians that these guys were dangerous characters. And, you know, apparently we didn't do enough on that. So, I mean, part of the problem is our intelligence apparatus has to be right 100% of the time, and the bad guys only have to be right 1% of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's almost seemingly impossible to do that, and you will always be able to point to a failure when one of these 1% things happen.
And most of the successes you'll never know.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about Leon Panetta.
I was just about to do the same thing.
You know,
didn't he write a book?
Well, he's written a book. He's been fairly critical of Obama, of the White House, and I'm just curious because we have a former secretaries of defense, both, well, especially Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, of the same political party as our current president, who don't seem to get into that debate and usually are very supportive while saying perhaps we should also be looking at this. And I'm just asking about, for a sitting president and especially a secretary of defense who served under this sitting president, of what we read into his comments.
I used to like Panetta.
That's past tense, Alan. Why do you now not like him?
I think it smacked of self-serving. I'm writing a book. I got to throw something in the book that's critical. You raised an interesting point there, Joe, which is Albright. Albright is a different story than Hillary. Hillary is about to run for president, we think. And she's saying, you know, why should I take this on? Why should I defend, a president?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Right.
Albright is another story.
Although she still takes that, she's very open-minded. She does quickly say, I'm not currently in the day-to-day discussions. I believe that we should look at it this way, but I understand the president and I have consulted. And she's certainly pointed, but she's also very conciliatory when it comes mm-hmm. to the current administration, an administration she did not serve in, by the way.
Right. But it's also, when you say those sort of platitudinal things, it's also cover. You know, I'm not in it day to day, but I think they're wrong. I mean, you know, that's...
Well, I don't think she's... I mean, normally she has been very supportive. I guess that's my point with Panetta mm-hmm. of not being... I mean, do we take this as something... And I guess that's my ultimate point of you saying, I don't like Panetta. Do we take this as someone... as something that we actually should be concerned about, or are we taking it from someone who seems to be irked by his experience and is playing this out with his background?
One other point that while you guys were talking about this, that it occurred to me, which is that not only does our system not always correspond with people abroad, but they don't always correspond with each other. They don't always talk to each other, which can even be, you know, have more serious consequences.
Well, just to go circle back a little bit to Joe's point, I mean, I think it's a little unseemly when cabinet officials that actually sit in administration leave and then write books about their experience and the administration's still in office.
That was unheard of like 20 years ago.
I mean, I don't know the answer to this question, but when Cyrus Vance resigned over the failed attempt to extract the Iranian hostages, where he thought the policy was wrong, so he resigned. I don't remember him writing a book. He might have. I would agree with that. I mean, I think it's sort of it's like you're profiting off of your public life when you go out, not only and blow the it's one thing, I guess, to blow the whistle. It's another thing to write a book and make millions of dollars off of it. That feels like you're profiting off your public service.
And it's also different, in my mind, when you have somebody like Henry Kissinger, who's been out of it for so long.
Some would say forever.
Yes, to then turn out and say, okay, I'm going to write a book on China, I'm going to write a book on this. But there's time there. It's different than saying of being an active part of the administration that's currently governing at this moment.
Cheap shot.
That Kissinger?
Cheap shot, actually.
No. Panetta.
Oh, yeah. Panetta. Okay, we're back.
as he was known earlier
somebody
in the morning as the Pink Panther. All
right, let's move on to other issues. Actually, we do have letters. We'll go for those, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back
on
other issues.
Bob from Albany says, foreign fighters. Sooner or later, Western countries being attacked by returning fighters will wise up and start revoking the passports of those who attempt to come back from combat zones if they can't demonstrate a benign reason for their travel. Until then, the internal attacks will continue. And our friend Don Steiner says, there's a level of irony in that France and Belgium are also countries with very high levels of anti-Israel rhetoric and violence. And then we're going back to the small businesses, and I don't think we need to go there, do we, Joe? You're the moderator.
No,
thank you for that. And more on that. Okay, so that's what I got.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about other issues. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org, WAMC.org/roundtable. We'll be back after the short break.
Support comes from New England Auctions, South Deerfield, Massachusetts. For 40 years, an international auction gallery offering fine art, books, maps, and antiques. 413-665-3253 for gallery and auction information. Binghamton University's Center of Excellence, advancing research in electronics packaging, solar power, flexible electronics, and green data centers. binghamton.edu/S3IP. And Bethel Woods Center for the Arts presents Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga and their Cheek to Cheek album tour at Bethel Woods Saturday, July 25th. Tickets available Monday, January 26th at BethelWoodsCenter.org.
Down in Alabama, 1955. Not many of us here today were then alive. A young Baptist preacher led a bus boycott. He showed a way for a brand new day without firing a shot.
Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King. You too can learn to sing, so drop the gun.
You can sing it with us. Don't say it can't be done. Sing that.
Don't say it can't be done.
Good. The battle's just begun. Sing that.
The battle's just begun.
Take it from Dr. King. Got it?
Take it from Dr. King.
You too can learn to sing. Got it?
You too can learn to sing.
So drop the gun.
So drop the gun.
Here we go.
Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun.
Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable discussion this morning with little Pete Seeger on this Martin Luther King anniversary and birthday.
A wonderful song. I love that song.
Good to hear. Reminder, we'll be having a special at 11 o'clock on Dr. King's legacy. That coming up at 11 this morning. Dr. Martin Luther King's Last Speech, I believe, is the title of the special that we will have at 11 o'clock this morning. We welcome your comments on what we're discussing this morning. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Ray Graff, Blair Horner, and I'm Joe Donahue. We welcome you to be with us as well. This broke on Friday, and the Supreme Court to decide marriage rights for couples nationwide. The Supreme Court on Friday agreed to decide whether all 50 states must allow gay and lesbian couples to marry, positioning it to resolve one of the great civil rights questions in a generation before its current term ends in June. The decision came just months after the justices ducked the issue, refusing in October to hear appeals from rulings allowing same-sex marriage in five states. That decision, which was considered a major surprise, delivered a tacit victory for gay rights, immediately expanding the number of states with same-sex marriage to 24, along with the District of Columbia, up from 19. There's silence in the room. No one willing to go to the microphone.
Well, it is interesting that they had punted on previous challenges to court, appellate level federal justices arguing that gay marriage, allowing gay marriage, was okay. And here's the case where the first level of federal courts has said, no, it's not okay, that you can, in fact, have a ban in the states of Michigan, Tennessee, and Ohio, and others, I think. I don't remember the states. And because there's a conflict at that level of the court, the legal system, the Supreme Court has to make a decision. So it's sort of interesting that in the past they have been unwilling to challenge, overturn, or to hear cases where there was a challenge to decisions that allowed gay marriage. But here's one where it's so it'll be interesting to see how
federalism and state and respecting states' decisions.
Right.
And so there was one exception, as reported in this article, New York Times, which was a 3-judge panel of the Court of Appeals basically said that voters and legislators, not judges, should decide the issue. So that's sort of the only one that is not federalism based, and that the feds should go along with what the state's wishes are.
And why did Brown versus Board of Education go the way that it did? Because they were giving people in the southern states the right to make that decision? I don't think so. I think what happened is that there's basic protection of minority rights in this country and interpreted as constitutional. Look, this federalism thing breaks both ways, Ray.
Well, that's the point of this article. There were two different ways to look at it. And the fact that the Supreme Court will look at it, I think, is fairly significant.
Yes, but what will they do? Tell us.
Well, you're Nostradamus. You tell me.
You've been
wrong about the Supreme Court many times,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, I have never been wrong about one thing. Five of them are stinkers, and that part I have not figured out. So what I can figure out is what the fifth one, what Kennedy will do on this, because and you know what, if you get inside John Roberts' head and try to figure out what it is he thinks he's doing in terms of preserving the court on Obamacare, he does what I consider to be the right thing. And allows the law to stand. Didn't have to do that, but he did it. Now, is this the kind of thing where he wants to endanger the reputation of the court by saying, no, you don't have the right to marry? What is it? What does he lose? What do they lose by allowing people to pursue their happiness? I don't get it. We see that in many states it's already happening. The world isn't collapsing. I think if I was a betting man, and as you say, Ray, I've been wrong many times.
About the Supreme Court.
About the Supreme Court. If I'm a betting man, I'm saying this would be a good time to get a little bit of political capital from everyone in the country.
Well, one of the comments that I heard on Friday night when this was announced, and I believe it was on NPR, it may have been BBC, but I think it was NPR, which was that the reason that this was going to the court this session was because they felt that with Ginsburg still in, that they would have, that the court would have the votes necessary to be able to address this and to kind of put it to bed for a while. Concerns that there would a changing face of the court would alter it and be dangerous. So I don't, not be able to advance the issue. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it was another side to the argument that I thought was interesting, and to your point about John Roberts and that concern as to what the impact of the court is overall, and especially when it comes to civil rights issues.
Yeah, I mean, this is not one of those you can give all the money to your campaigns, something that Blair has always been interested in, decisions. In other words, this is now something that may seem like it's monumental, and it may be for many, but it doesn't get to their core values as a court, as a conservative court, I think.
Well, and I think enough people, you know, I mean, society's changed a lot. I mean, it's not clearly as partisan an issue as it was even 5 years ago.
Or even 2 years ago.
Right. I mean, but it'll be interesting to see what the court says. I mean, the court, as I understand it, has sort of been ruling that it's really the state's authority to deal with how they want to deal with their own marriage laws. And is
that's
there
basically them staying out of the big
right,
question.
That's right. And so is there a way to thread the needle to say that a state, because right now the initial reason why you have varying courts of appeals, federal courts of appeals in conflict in the United States, the Supreme Court has to resolve it. So they have to take the case. Do they try to find some sort of way that they can sort of thread the needle and say that states are allowed to do a certain thing, but they have to recognize marriages done in other states, some way where they try to thread the needle on this particular thorny matter?
Or do they
do? Or they just go for the whole enchilada?
Or do they do Brown versus Board of Education, which is segregation is inherently bad. Everybody has a right to be married, and cut it out. That's a possibility, too.
There was an interesting article in the Times about about how Republicans were looking at this as offering GOP a political cover on the issue because they said if the high court resolves the issue as expected in June, it could deliver a decision that has the benefit of largely neutralizing a debate that a majority of Americans believe Republicans are on the wrong side of and well ahead of the party's 2016 presidential primaries.
And a lot depends on who the next president of the United States is going to be.
Right.
I mean, if it's going to be Hillary Clinton and she gets maybe one or two appointments to the court, it'll certainly be less important than if it's a Republican who may, in fact, campaign on what Alan would consider the wrong side of this issue.
Well, ironically, the true Nostradamus in this could turn out to be Scalia, who argued, I guess, in the Windsor case, where they overturned the Defense of Marriage Act, that basically the court was opening up full rights for same-sex marriage. And so it may turn out, ironically, that Scalia was the true Nostradamus, Ray, not Alan.
Not Alan?
No, not on this one.
I have no idea why that would be.
We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. We're just about out of time. Final issue, Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy arrived in Cuba on Saturday to discuss greater cooperation and remaining areas of disagreement. It was also announced over the weekend that Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York has interest in going to Cuba and is planning a trip, according to his office, on Saturday. So this is a political issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly is. Yes, and we have a guest coming in to tell us what's
going on. Yes, well, give me your thoughts on this, and then we'll get
up there. No. So my thoughts on this is we have aged out in Florida, which was the deciding place. Young Cubans are
Cuba's
all for it.
Cuba's the new Florida?
What'd you say?
So is Cuba going to be the new Florida? Is that what you're saying?
No, Adam? No, that's clever, but no. no. By the way, that is something that people are worried about, right? That the character of the Cubans of Cuba will change. But young Cubans who vote are not with their folks and their parents and their grandparents on this. So there's been a big change.
One of the things that we want to bring you up to date on over the next couple weeks before the fun drive, 2 weeks to be exact, is that we want to tell you how we're doing on our lockbox. And for that, we go to Megan Finnegan, who has the latest numbers. She'll tell you what's at stake here. But Alan, just let you set it up real quick of what we're looking at.
We are looking at the survival of WAMC. That's what we're looking at. And whether or not we can just send a message to everybody that we could do halfway in the fun drive by the time we start, Ray. And I'm looking at
2 weeks.
Be looking at your face across the way.
Don't worry, I got this. We'll be fine. Two weeks from now.
Okay. Yeah. But it's going to be hard. It's really going to be hard. But we could do it. Ray may just send in the keys. Okay. Yeah. So what do we got?
Well, so far we have $366,015 in lockbox.
Wow. What was that?
$366,015.
2 weeks to go until the fund drive begins.
So we need about $140,000. Now, before you all say, right? Is that right?
Yeah, $133,000 if you want to get halfway.
And before you tell me it can't be done, I just want to mention that in many days, in the fund drive itself, almost every day is a $100,000 day now. So that doesn't seem like we could be done with our halfway by tomorrow if everybody just, did something.
Also, from my understanding, right, if you say we couldn't do this, we did it at this time last year, right?
We did halfway.
Did we really?
We did the best we've ever done last February, and it was because of the year end. A lot of people give it the year end or at the beginning of the year, making their resolutions, and we got to 425 when we started.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So we got to beat that.
So we have to get halfway.
Yeah.
Reputation rests on.
Okay.
Well, we do have an excellent new premium too for people.
Tell us about that.
I know you put paperwork in here, but I think it was shuttled.
Is that the thing here? Isn't it here?
It was here before.
It's the water bottle.
Stainless steel water bottle.
Yeah. So stainless steel is beautiful.
It is, and it has
a secret ingredient in it.
What is
and
that?
And it ain't Pappy. It ain't Pappy. No. Whatever, Van Winkle. It has when you're in the car and the stuff splashes on you.
Yeah.
This will not splash on you because it has sort of how you call it on top of it.
A guard.
A spigot.
It has something.
A cover?
It has, well.
By the way,
if your grandchild Noah was having it, it would be called a nipple. But it's
all
not,
right,
you know.
Fine.
You see what I mean?
It has a straw.
It's not a straw exactly, is it? It's a permanent straw, maybe.
Yes, a permanent
it's a nozzle.
Straw.
You know, by the way, sitting with Alan at the meeting, like Alan saying, "Now, what is that? That's the water bottle. What's the thing on the top? That's the
straw."
Yeah.
Now that we've described it, you can go on to the actual WAMC webpage.
But get what's on the bottle?
Well, whatever you want to put in there within.
Wait a second.
Characters.
Is that true?
We're gonna have to. Okay, we want Lee Marinoff, right?
To be continued.
Okay, we gotta go.
Oh,
thanks.